This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik, and it is that time of the month again for our Open Clinic segment. Today, we'll be addressing all of your concerns when it comes to skin health. And in the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong ZY, Consultant Dermatologist and Dermatological Surgeon. So if you have any questions, please call us. Our lines are open and waiting for you. 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp them over 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So the number again for calls 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. How are you today, Dr. Adrian?
I'm great, thank you.
Dr. Adrian, since the start of the MCO, well, how's it been for, I guess, everyone is concerned about staying safe from the virus. But, you know, as a skin specialist, what have you been seeing in terms of patients coming to your clinic?
It's very interesting that you ask, because people, even during the peak of the MCO, were still seeking help for skin problems. In fact, some of them were actually getting worse, and I think it has an effect on increasing cortisol levels and increasing stress levels. So a lot of people with very bad acne outbreak, possibly from poor diet, maybe too rich foods, you know, staying indoors and just feeling generally not the usual self. And that was the initial phase of the MCO. As time went on, we began to see more and more people with hand eczema and mask-related eczema.
That's something that I'd like to get into because of the use of face masks and hand sanitizers now. But coming back to stress, that is one of the things I wanted to ask you. What is the effect of stress on the skin?
Okay, so stress can affect a lot of the aspects of the skin. First of all, if you're not having regular sleep patterns, especially having odd sleep times, it can affect the sebaceous gland hyperactivity, which means that your face starts to produce more oil. Okay. Secondly, the skin turnover also changes with time, and it leads to a lot of clogging up the pores and generally a poor and dull skin tone. Now, the second thing, of course, is when someone is stressed, they have less time to look after themselves and perhaps worry about their finances more and looking into other things that needs doing at home. So those things can start taking self-care away from themselves, which they usually do. And of course, the more important thing is that they're not able to go out to their regular facials, their regular maintenance treatments, which some people really require on a regular basis.
All right. And I want to talk about the fact that I guess many people were staying indoors, especially during the main MCO period. What is the effect of that and perhaps the lack of exposure to sun on our skin?
Yes. So sunlight is quite beneficial in regulating our circadian rhythm in terms of sleep cycle. Secondly, it can also give us happiness by being in the sun in a brighter area. I mean, when I used to live in England in the past, there was a very well-recognized condition known as the seasonal affective disorder, and appropriately acronym as, you know, SAD or SAD, because the lack of sunlight during winter really affects people and makes them very depressed and lethargic and, you know, just not having the drive to do anything.
So lack of sun, not being as happy, and that sort of translates, you see the effects physically, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
So let's talk about the hand and face eczema. So, you know, what kinds of skin issues are you seeing as a result of people having to wear a lot of, having to wear face masks very frequently now?
I think in the first phase, when face masks weren't as used as much, there were much less incidences because people were not wearing it regularly. Plus, they were actually at home, so they're not wearing that for long hours. But the first wave of people who got them were healthcare workers. So you can see on Facebook and all the streams that, you know, people were getting erosions on their noses and their cheeks were red. And a lot of the, you know, it was spread all the news from the medics in China as well, who had the same kind of injuries, N95 related injuries. Now, the second wave actually really came to us after that when the MCO was relaxed slightly more. And general public were then expected to wear masks as a social responsibility issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I started to get a lot more patients coming in complaining of irritation, firstly from the surgical disposable masks, which had a few components that may cause irritation. So one of them was, of course, the elastic bands, for which some people who are allergic to latex were having problems with, especially mm-hmm. around their ears and the sides of their cheeks.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of it was certain chemicals, including formaldehyde and quaternium-15, which were used as preservatives in the manufacture process of masks. And those were causing problems as well. So how do we know that? I mean, patients who are allergic to the anti-wrinkle products, so if you were to take a brand new shirt off the shelf and not wash it, those anti-wrinkle products that are based in those fabrics are formaldehyde-based.
Mm.
So they would tend to get rashes as soon as they wore them. And that was one of the key identifying questions we would ask the patients. And very rapidly, the solution to that is to change to fabric-based masks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But fabric-based masks also has different sets of issues
mm-hmm.
in relation to how it's washed. For example, if it's detergents, which are very strongly scented with perfumes and fragrances, that can also cause problems, especially if you're wearing it for long periods, because with perspiration, trapping of heat and moisture, that actually leaches the fragrances or whatever chemicals that's used to wash the masks out
mm.
onto the face. And that then causes an allergic reaction 2 or 3 days later.
All right.
Yeah.
And what about the N95 masks?
Mm. So N95 masks, the main problem with that was the pressure effect that it caused on nose and on the cheeks.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the bands are, you know, just pure elastic. That causes a lot of irritation from just pressure. So some of patients who had urticaria, which is a condition which is also known as hives, they look like mosquito bite reactions upon applying pressure to your skin. That can cause a big problem when you are wearing very, very tight pieces of clothing and also N95 included.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then, of course, the other thing is if the N95 is really worn for long hours, besides the skin problems that they get, sometimes you have a buildup of carbon dioxide because the fact that you can't breathe very freely gives people headaches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one of the other issues that patients wearing N95s have.
All right. Yeah. Is there a general rule of thumb that we can follow when it comes to how long we should have a mask on our faces?
Mm. I'm afraid there's no guidance on that. And I think it's risk versus benefit ratio here.
Of course.
I think the answer to that is as short but as safely as possible.
Mm.
So, for example, if you're just walking out to pick a takeaway up, you should wear a mask, and when you come back to the car, sanitize your hands and then dispose of the mask in a bag and, ditch it somewhere.
Mm.
But, I see some people still wearing the mask and probably they've forgotten and they're still driving alone in the car with the mask on. And that's obviously causing the problems that we're seeing today.
Oh, I see, of course. Would these masks aggravate acne?
Yes, definitely so. So the causation of acne are, of course, a fewfold. Genetics plays a part. Lifestyle, stress levels, dietary substances can also cause that. But of course, trapping of moisture, buildup of keratin or dead skin on the surface adds to that. And that's the perfect area under a mask, which is moisture being trapped, bacteria from the mouth, especially when you're speaking a lot. And all these things get trapped under the mask. And with the moisture, it's basically you're having a... It's like having a facial, but facial of your bacterial products onto your skin.
Oh!
So it's essentially...
Not pleasant.
Yeah, so essentially, that is what you're getting. And so it's unsurprising that you get acne.
All right. Yeah. So for those who do have a history of acne or who tend to be prone to it, perhaps if they're using masks, like you've said, if you don't need to be wearing them, if you're in a privacy somewhere,
mm-hmm.
that you could take them off, right? But I'm also thinking of people who work in certain sectors where they are facing people all the time and they do have to keep the masks on. Would changing to fresh ones help?
Yes, certainly so. And I think the guidance now is that if your mask feels moist, then you should be changing it. For example, if you can see water droplets on the front, from maybe a runny nose or something, mm-hmm. something similar to that, then you should certainly be changing it. The other tip is, whenever you go to the washroom, if you have a chance, you can take the mask off, just give the face a rinse, pat dry it, and then wear the mask again, because you get rid of all the surface bacteria that builds up.
All right. Okay. And speaking of acne, we do have a question here from a listener. I'm 24 years old and I still regularly get severe acne on my face. Why is this so, even though, you know, I'm long past my teenage years?
I think that's a myth that we've been answering all this while. With regards to acne, genetics plays a major part. So if your parents have very severe acne, that can last till even your 30s or 40s. I have patients in their mid-40s who are still getting sort of a female pattern acne related to androgens or testosterone spikes. And this tend to happen premenstrual, meaning before your period starts on, maybe 3 or 4 days before. It tends to go around the chin and the jawline area. Okay,
right.
So it's not uncommon, but of course, the rates of people with severe acne at the age of 40, 45 is maybe around 5%. Whereas that in teenagers are closer to 60, 70% mm-hmm. in terms of severity. So, you know, that's one factor, of course. Now, the next part is dietary. So 20 years ago, we would have said, you know, it's rubbish to not think about diets and all that. It's okay, you can eat whatever you want. But actually, increasing evidence has shown that full-fat milk, a high carbohydrate diet, i.e. high glycemic index foods, chocolates, and fried foods, tend to increase sebaceous or oil gland activity.
You've just named everything that tastes good.
Yes, because we live in Malaysia. Yeah.
But so if these you know, can sort of aggravate acne, I mean aggravate the production of sebum, is the advice to stay away from them completely or?
Well, I think this advice is very individual. So it has to be personalized in the way that if you were genetically not predisposed to acne, maybe you get one or two spots just before your period, then that's fine. You know, you carry on enjoying your food. But if you were coming to me with very severe inflammatory acne, meaning there's pus coming out, then I'll tell you to stay away from that for at least 1 or 2 months whilst we're treating you, just to increase your chances of recovery in a rapid fashion. Because prolonged severe acne, which is inflamed, leads to a lot of scarring. And the ugly ones are generally basically the ice pick scars, which looks like someone has used an ice pick to carve out holes in your face. And secondly, post-inflammatory or after inflammation, hyperpigmentation, which are the dark spots that you tend to get after very severe acne has passed through. And that can take months and months for it to settle.
All right. Okay? All right. So stay away from what you know are going to be triggers, I suppose, until you can get it cleared up.
Yes.
But as a general rule, I suppose, if you know that these do flare up acne, well, you know what you have to do, unfortunately, no matter how good this full-fat milk and the fried foods taste. We have a few questions on WhatsApp. We'll get to them after our quick break. Do call us 0377332900, WhatsApp 0187898899, or tweet us at BFM Radio if you have any skin-related questions, because it's our Ask a Doctor segment. Is the Open Clinic on Skin Health, and I have in the studio with me Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong ZY, Consultant Dermatologist and Dermatological Surgeon, to answer your questions. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong ZY, Consultant Dermatologist and Dermatological Surgeon. Today is our Open Clinic segment on skin health, and we would like to hear from you. What are your concerns when it comes to your skin? Anything that you'd like to share with us? Our lines are open 0377332900. You can also WhatsApp them to us at 0187898899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Earlier, you know, Dr. Adrian, we were already talking quite a bit about the use of face masks and the impact on the skin, the kinds of irritation that it can cause. And we do have a question here. Are you more prone to getting acne if you're wearing makeup under your face mask?
Yeah, so makeups, if you're using mineral oil-based makeups, that can be very occlusive on its own. So on top of that, if you're having the mask, which I mentioned earlier, that creates a little bacterial film on the top, then you're adding two risk factors to developing severe acne.
All right. And so what would your recommendation be? Changing the type of makeup or just cutting down on the use of makeup if you're wearing masks?
I think I would advise the use of a very fashionable mask and probably keeping it on rather than having your makeup under the mask. and only perhaps reapplying it for social interactions when it needs be.
All right. Treading on very sensitive ground here. We also have Zaidi who messaged in. Zaidi has been suffering from eczema all over his body since he was 9. He's now 48 and still has eczema, is on treatment for it. He says that doctors have told him that eczema will disappear as he gets older, but it's not the case for him. He wants to know, will it be lifelong for him?
Okay, so eczema in its own definition is just describing the skin being red, inflamed and peeling and is itchy. Okay, but there are many different subtypes of eczema. So the one that is most well known, and I think Zainal probably has this, is atopic eczema. Atopic refers to a tendency towards allergies. And number one, they will tend to have allergic rhinitis, so runny nose, sneezing, maybe itching around the eyes to start with, followed by eczema or atopic eczema, basically affecting the skin folds in the arms and the legs, and thirdly, possibly asthma as well. Now, atopic eczema originates from two problems. One is a barrier disruption issue. So if you imagine our skin being a brick wall with normally what is supposed to be cement between them to make it waterproof. Now, people with atopic eczema have brick walls, but without the concrete between them. So in other words, any rain that comes along, any pollutants that comes along can just go right in and your immune system will then see it very easily. Okay. So the first step is to really moisturize well at all times to minimize the flare-ups that comes along with exposure to external triggers.
All right.
Now, second thing, of course, is the immune system itself. Now, immune system itself, you have two main types of allergic pathways. One is the immediate type. Example, prawn, seafood consumption may lead to hives or urticaria, like mosquito bite reactions, which passes within half an hour. Second type is the delayed type reaction, eczema. So again, this is allergic contact eczema, nickel. So for example, you wear earrings and you're allergic to nickel, a rash will start to appear on the ears, 2 days later. And this rash, this allergic reaction actually escalates with time, meaning that an exposure in childhood and subsequent exposures in adulthood will lead to more and more severe cases, whereby the even a short exposure of within maybe half an hour, will lead to the reaction coming up.
Okay.
Now, so the key things are, number one, to provide good barrier. Number two, to control the immune system. Now, but how do we control the immune system? We have to find out what we're allergic to. So number one, there's a type of blood test known as the IgE test or immunoglobulin E test. And that screens through a lot of the allergens, including things that we breathe in, like house dust mite, cat dander, pet dander, etc., trees, pollen. And then there's also the food types, which are seafood, meat, protein-based. Okay? Now that will pick up the immediate type allergy. The second type of test is known as the skin patch test. The patch test, as rudimentary as it sounds, is really critical. So for example, if I was to identify what my patients are allergic to in terms of makeup, we can actually put their whole panel of all their personal care products on a simple thin chamber patch, which is hypoallergenic, and that's then pasted to the back, left on for 2 days, and then we remove it and we try and look for reactions to see whether they're allergic to it. So whenever patients come to me with severe chronic eczema, I would go through these two considerations first. And once we find out things that they can avoid, at least that's one part of the story looked after. Second part of the story, avoiding triggers. If you know you're allergic to something, there's no point testing it if you're not committed to avoiding it. So, you know, I've got patients who have dogs at home, and I ask them one question. If you were found to be allergic to dog dander, will you move them out? And if the answer is no, then I don't do the test. Because that just makes them very sad.
That's
and it
right.
doesn't change.
There's nothing any, that they can do. They are willing to do.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And then, of course, in the long run, there are newer medications now that we can use to regulate the immune system to prevent the flare-ups. So, you know, there's a lot of medications or things that can be done out there to allow severe chronic eczema patients to live as normal a life as possible now.
All right.
So you shouldn't go on suffering.
All right. And speaking of medications, we do have a question here from somebody who suffers from severe eczema on her legs, and she's tried many kinds of steroid creams over the years. And she says that they don't provide much long-term effect. Mm. So she's in her late 20s, she says.
Mm. Yeah. So now the first thing I would do is examine the underlying skin there. And if you use cross-lighting, so if you have a torchlight at home and you just put it across tangential, as in parallel to the skin surface of your shin or the legs, and you start seeing some fish scale patterns or like the surface of a desert like crackland, then you may have something called ichthyosis, or in Greek word, it's actually a fish scale skin type. Now, that predisposes you to severe eczema not because of allergies, but purely because your skin is extremely dry all the time. And in Malaysia, you may not notice it, but as soon as you start traveling to places with lower humidity, like the UK, US, and so on, when you come back, you have very, very severe eczema flaring up on the legs. Now, of course, the second thing is if you're using soaps which are very harsh, I can't mention any brands, but I mean any surfactants that causes a lot of stripping of the oil, you might feel very clean, but actually that's doing a disservice to your skin because it makes it even drier. Okay, so number one, if your skin is extremely dry, then it's very prone to irritation. When it's prone to irritation, it's very prone to the very pleasurable cycle of scratch and itch, where you scratch and you feel good and you keep scratching until it bleeds, and then it gets infected.
All right.
Okay, now, so the first thing is to find out what the underlying cause is. So by examining the skin, if you've got ichthyosis, you need to moisturize very consistently every time after you shower. Get rid of those soaps which creates a lot of foam.
Mm-hmm.
For some patients, I actually tell them to wash just with water unless it's very visibly soiled or very, very oily.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. The other thing is, of course, habitual. So I've had patients who had eczema all their life, and despite removing all the trigger factors, despite moisturizing, they're still scratching. So there have been a lot of studies to show that patients who have long-term eczema have gotten used to the fact that it's very pleasurable to scratch. And it's kind of like of a reward. So as soon as they sit down to watch the television and they have nothing to do, their finger starts reaching down, even when it's not itchy scratch.
Okay.
And it's a habitual thing. So again, to prevent those things, there are a few extreme things that we can do. One is putting moisturizers, okay, or light appropriate strength steroids to those areas and wrapping it up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you can't get access to those areas. These are the things that we do to younger kids because you can't tell them not
to
scratch.
That's right.
Okay, so that's one. Now, the thing with the use of long-term steroids, now, this leads to concerns of the side effects of topical steroids, where it may lead to skin thinning. It might lead to a very obvious blood vessel exposure. And if the quantity is used sufficiently, it is as though you're taking oral steroids, which means that you might have all the long list of side effects that is associated with that, including osteoporosis, diabetes, gastric ulceration, increasing hairiness or increased hair growth, etc. So the way I would put this is a little bit like if you were using brakes, i.e. steroids, and if you apply it, you press on your brakes, and then maybe momentarily for 5 minutes or so, and then you let it go. Now, why is your car moving forward still at breakneck speed? You need to ask yourself that question. Is it that you are aggravating it with soaps, drying it out? Or is it that you have a bad habit? Or is it that perhaps you have a hobby, for example, or even a occupational hazard, like if you're a yoga instructor and you're wearing very tight clothing, tights can rub on the skin, and that can cause local irritation too. And the list goes on. So you need to find that root cause of the problem, and you can solve it.
All right. And Kat wants to know, on that point about harsh soaps, are there certain chemicals that we can look out for to avoid?
Now, the chemical name, a generic one, is called sodium lauryl sulfate or lauryl sulfate. Yeah, and these are basically surfactants which strips the or separate oil off. So the ones that are typically very high in these levels are things which are in your dishwashing liquid.
Okay? Which you shouldn't be putting on your skin.
And also when you start lathering yourself and you're showering, you actually start to see bubbles and foam. And that's actually the surfactant acting. So unfortunately, the kind of personal care products here, because of the mass market that requires oil stripping because of our weather, the ones that do not have surfactants are very few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unlike in the colder less humid countries where, strictly speaking, they have totally no surfactants at all.
Mm.
And so even the skin-friendly brands you might see in our local pharmacy, which claims to be skin-friendly, will have sodium lauryl sulfate. And that's a disappointing thing to see.
All right.
And in fact, the very sort of cheap and cheerful approach is using conventional creams to shower. Now, you heard me right. Using a cream to shower.
Cream to shower. Okay.
Yes. So actually, some of them have a bit of surfactants in there because they have to separate oil from the water. And actually, you can utilize that because it's a two-in-one. It moisturizes and it washes at the same time.
Oh.
But a lot of patients don't believe me until they've read something else on that. Yeah. But this was the mainstay in the UK National Health Service system. We were using that for all patients. We were using the creams that were very commonly prescribed. And it's not expensive at all. Costs 15 ringgit in the local pharmacy here. You can use that to shower.
So you use it, you lather, well, I say lather, quote unquote, with water as you would with soap.
Yes, but you would not get the foam and the satisfaction of a very
squeaky
dry,
clean.
Yes, you will feel slightly greasy after. Mm. And that's what it's meant to be when you have eczema.
I see. Yeah. All right. You know, we'll go for a quick break again. And when we come back, we've got a few more questions on WhatsApp. Do call us 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong ZY, consultant dermatologist and dermatological surgeon, to answer your questions about skin health. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao-Ik. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong. He's a consultant dermatologist and dermatological surgeon, and he's here to talk about skin health. So if you have any questions when it comes to your skin, call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Ibrahim is asking on WhatsApp, what about cystic acne? He says that the normal skin cleansers don't work on his skin because he has cystic acne.
So I'll just go through very briefly the four stages of acne. First, sebaceous gland or oil gland production. Okay, so that's the main root cause of the problem. Secondly, overbuilding of dead skin, plugging the oil secretion pores. Okay, that causes comedones or black or white heads. Okay, now when it's critically blocked, you move on to the third stage, which is inflammatory acne with papules and pustules. And then the fourth stage, which is cystic acne that Ibrahim has just mentioned. So by the time you're getting cystic acne, these are very, very deep-seated ones that has a very high chance of forming ice pick scars or very depressed scar areas once it heals. Now, so when you think about the different mechanisms, the face wash cleansers, which may contain things like salicylic acid or fruit acids to de-slough or remove the dead skin on the surface, only tackles one component. The oil production part, you will still need to tackle that, perhaps with a vitamin A-based gel cream or even tablets, which can be prescribed by dermatologists. And if you have inflammatory papules, pustules, and cystic acne, you will also need oral or topical antibiotics to sterilize or disinfect the area. And generally speaking, when you start having cystic acne, I would classify that as very severe, almost like an emergency in our specialty.
Mm.
Because what happens next is scarring, and the scarring will require lasers, procedures to lift up the scars. And sometimes it doesn't ever clear up, even with all the procedures done. So prevention is better than cure.
All right. Another question. My husband, now at 48, still gets pimples on his face, scalp, neck, shoulder and back and front of body. And we noticed that more pimples and mouth ulcers develop when he eats anything dairy. They have seen a gastroenterologist who says that it is not related to the gut. So they are trying to get some guidance here. Pimples. He has been having pimples and mouth ulcers since he was a teenager as well.
Okay. So two separate issues. Let's talk about the pimples first. So pimples, as I've mentioned through, number one, genetics. Number two, any particular medications that you might be taking. So certain medications can increase oil secretion. Okay. And thirdly, dietary lifestyle. Okay. Those things really play a part. So if your husband's face is generally very oily the whole time, then he needs a medication to control that. Okay. Now, coming back to oral ulcers, now oral ulcers can be due to a whole host of things. Number one is called the aphthous ulcer, which is due to what the Chinese say as heatiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you consume too much durian or too much alcohol, not consuming enough water, that can cause ulcers. Okay. Now, second thing is having a very exciting food, spicy foods, things which are heavily salted, that can cause local injury to the oral cavity. And of course, things that you might be wearing, dentures, perhaps adaptations for the mouth, for breathing, etc., that can also cause problems. And then you move on to things which you use, for example, mouth rinses and toothpaste. Those things may contain preservatives or irritants like alcohol-based or antiseptics, which may not be that suitable to be used too frequently. So in other words, if you're using it once a day and the rinse time is probably 30 seconds or so, that's fine. But if your husband has an obsessive nature to try and clean everything out, 2 cycles, 5 minutes each, 3 times a day, that will start to cause problems with oral ulcerations.
Mm-hmm.
Now then, of course, we move on to the weird and wonderful rarer things where you can have drug reactions such as Stevens-Johnson syndrome due to allergy to painkillers or to antibiotics, but those are normally short-lived. Within a few weeks, you either recover from it by getting the diagnosis right or you end up hospitalized in ICU or intensive care unit because it's missed and the condition gets worse. And then there are a few autoimmune conditions, one of which is known as Behçet's disease, spelled as B-E-H-C-E-T-S. Okay, now, that can be accompanied by genital and oral ulceration, and that needs to be worked up very carefully because you need some special immunosuppressive treatments to regulate the immune system to prevent recurrence.
All right. Just very quickly, because you've mentioned food now, and so has this listener talked about dairy products, are you seeing or are you observing a rise in skin conditions? And, you know, what do we know about its link with the gut microbiome?
Hmm. That's a very interesting one. So I think the first angle I'll look at is the use of probiotics and the evidence available in treating eczema. And so there's a Cochrane review, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. Basically, it's a accumulation of all the studies and looking at how much evidence there is that probiotics help eczema. There's not much, in fact. So a lot of it is driven by commercialization, but it's insufficient for healthcare systems and government-funded healthcare systems particularly to use that as a treatment. Okay, now, but if you're looking at sort of the link of things like seborrheic dermatitis, which is yeast overgrowth on the forehead and the scalp and the sides of the nose, and consumption of yogurts and yeast, there seems to be some signal. Okay, the scientific studies don't really conclude that there is a link, but in clinical practice, we do see a slight link there.
Mm.
Okay, so it's not as clear-cut as what the studies show. You need higher numbers to look at those.
All right. Another question. The edge of my lips on my upper lip have been constantly peeling, and I'm trying to avoid steroid creams. What can I do to help with it?
Okay, so lip eczema can be, number one, due to irritation. So look into the toothpaste that you used, any lip moisturizers that you use, potential allergens or irritants there. Okay. Secondly, habit. Do you have a habit of licking your lips? Because that may cause secondary yeast infection because our mouth is covered with bacteria and yeast. And with secondary infection of the already irritated dry lips, that can become more and more widespread where you start having a rim around the lip as though you're having a second lip. Okay. Now, then the third part is nutritional deficiencies. We know that there's a condition called angulocheilitis, which can be due to folic acid, iron or B12 deficiency. And that tends to happen in ladies who are post-pregnancy, they're breastfeeding, and that can start happening. Okay, so those are the common things. So if it's been going on for a long time, I think the first thing is barrier protection first, using a paraffin-based ointment. I'm not allowed to use anything that's remotely close to a brand. So
yes.
Either just say a generic paraffin-based ointment, which is very thick. Okay, and you can use that as a barrier so that it's waterproof and it doesn't dry out. And then secondly, avoid things which make it worse. For example, spicy foods, salty items. and perhaps look into getting supplements to cover those three aspects that we just talked about earlier.
All right.
That would be my first line. Second line would be to do a patch test if you're using a lip moisturizer, which may be aggravating it, or if you suspect that that's a toothpaste that you can't part with, that you really want to find out whether you're allergic to it or not.
All right.
Okay.
Another question. I have keloids and have done cryo-freezing and steroid injections, but they come back after a month. What should I do?
So now, keloids are a very, very tricky thing to manage. And essentially, they are abnormal scar tissue formation. The predisposing factors are, number one, the ethnic group. So if you're a darker skin type, then you're more likely to develop them. Secondly, if you have any friction or trauma to high skin tension sites, like, for example, the chest and perhaps the midline area of your body, then it tends to recur. Now, I generally have a rule of thumb that if I'm injecting and using cryo, three sessions, 1 month apart, and it's not shifting, meaning it's not clearing, then I would have to seriously consider a surgical option to remove the bulky scar tissue and follow that up with very frequent, i.e. 3 to 4 weekly steroid injections to regulate the scar healing process. Okay, so I've done that on earlobes very successfully, where we can remove the bulky extra, it looks like an extra earlobe hanging, you know, like a long piece hanging off. And we just cut it off. We do a flap repair to make sure that we've got enough skin coverage. And then we start following up every 3 to 4 weeks to treat it. And my success rate is 100% right now for the ear keloids. Now, chest keloids are a little bit more tricky because it's a high tension area. Basically, whenever you are doing push-ups, that will be stretching the chest. Mm-hmm. Whenever you put seat belts that goes across creates a lot of friction and rubbing that leads to itching. And itching is always the first sign that keloid is making a comeback. Okay. Now, the other thing to look into is also the concentration of the steroid that is being injected. So different doctors will dilute it by different aspects. And if it's too dilute, it may not work at all.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a little bit too strong, it might lead to side effects such as depressed areas around, like the moat of a castle around the keloid after an injection.
Right.
So there's a fine balance between the two. But I think essentially if you've had three goes 1 month apart, then I think it's time to reconsider the option rather than going on it long term, unless surgery is definitely a no-no for you.
All right.
Yeah.
But he mentioned cryo-freezing. That's different from surgery.
Yeah. So cryos is using liquid nitrogen. And the concept here is to peel off the top layer of the skin and also to reduce blood vessel formation. Because keloids basically are abnormal scar tissue resulting from the presence of a lot of active blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So we often use that together, injections plus the cryo to prevent it.
Yeah. Okay. And very quickly, because steroid injections were brought up, someone wants to know about when steroid jabs are used for treating eczema, are there any negative side effects?
Hmm. Well, I think injections, if my general rule of thumb is using three jabs in a year maximum. And I would say that we shouldn't be using that as a long-term management because we have a lot of other steroid-sparing agents, i.e. immunosuppressives, the new biologic injections, albeit more pricey, but they are much safer than long-term oral or injectable steroids. So if you're having more than three injections in a year spaced out once every 4 months, then I would certainly say that you have to make sure that you are doing your best in terms of allergen detection first, followed by barrier protection. And then if everything else fails, we would be using immunosuppressives, which are steroid sparing.
All right. A very quick question from Walter. Can you put moisturizer over pimple cream?
Very good point. So now we want to put moisturizers on because we want to repair the skin barrier. And when would the skin barrier be broken? Perhaps when you use things like benzoyl peroxide, which are the commonly available over-the-counter pimple spot treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And also perhaps topical or applied antibiotics, which often comes in bottles with rollers on top, and they are alcohol-based. Now, those ones can irritate the skin and cause peeling, as though you're having a sunburn. So whenever you wash your face, it feels like it's really stinging. Mm. And moisturizers in that circumstance can be very useful. But I think that if you're getting irritation and you're still applying benzoyl peroxide, alcohol-based topical antibiotics, then I think you should stop for a while and just give it a break for maybe a day or so. Just put moisturizers on, let it rest, and then resume using the products again afterwards when it's less irritable.
Okay. Another question. Sometimes my skin looks like it has bruises, but it's not from any known injuries. And then it clears up after a few days or a week or so. What could be causing that?
Mm. Okay. So it depends on which site of the body you're looking at. Is it the shins? Is it the around the eyes? Or is it the arms? So there are two main things. One is a coagulation disorder, where you have a bleeding disorder. And you might not have sufficient factors to allow your blood to clot. And that can be a problem. Now, if there's such a suspicion, then you should be seeing a hematologist, meaning a blood specialist, to have that worked up and to identify what factors need to be replaced or corrected. Now, the second thing that's quite common in our practice as dermatologists is capillaritis or vasculitis, whereby blood vessels get inflamed and blood cells leak out. And when you press on the skin, the redness or blood that has seeped under the skin does not clear. So typically, I think if you've seen pictures of dengue sufferers, you'd see vasculitis on the leg. Okay, if someone has gone for a long hike and they were traumatizing their lower legs a lot, they might get capillaritis, where their blood vessels actually burst open and the red cells leak out.
Right.
So I've seen that happening around people's faces from a vigorous game of badminton.
Mm.
And also on arms, on inner arms, if you're swinging too hard in a golf course or you're having a recoil from badminton shots and squash games, that's pretty normal. It normally passes maybe after 2 or 3 days. But if you're having recurrent bruising, then I think that needs a workup with a hematologist.
Okay. Just very quickly, we're using hand sanitizers a lot more now. What's the effect on the skin?
Okay. So I'll take this opportunity to share as well that hand sanitizers, which are alcohol-based, should only be used when you're out and about and not at home. Simply because the high content of alcohol strips the barrier completely. And even for a non-eczema sufferer, they will start to have over dryness of the skin, followed by peeling skin, followed by eczema. Okay, so that can very often happens on the back of the hands, which hasn't really seen such harsh stuff for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the palms and your soles, which are very thick, and they have a protective barrier that only gives in at the very last moment. The moment your fingertips starts to give way, it means that you've been overusing, alcohol-based sanitizers. So that's why it brings me back to the point that if you're at home and you can wash your hands just with soap and water, followed by applying moisturizers afterwards, that will be the best sequence to maintain the skin barrier.
Okay.
So basically, to summarize with that, the effects are drying, irritation, and potentially, if there are preservatives in them that doesn't agree with you, it may form allergic contact dermatitis or allergies.
All right. And as you said, if you are just at home or perhaps in an office where you can wash your hands with soap, that's what you should be doing instead.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, okay. Because the alcohol-based hand sanitizers stay on the skin for, 30 minutes to an hour. The other thing that I thought I'll mention as well, that, the guidance for doctors mainly with the use of alcohol hand sanitizers in hospital is after every 4 or 5 applications of the alcohol-based sanitizer, you're meant to wash with soap and water. Why? Because it starts to start to feel flaky. And also the amount of microbes which are already sitting on the skin, you are already saturated with that on the skin surface. So just by applying another layer of this hand sanitizer does not make it efficient anymore.
Okay.
So again, I think if you can, soap and water is still more effective.
All right. Just very quickly, I think I'll take this last question. Sivanis wants to know, if a person has just been diagnosed with psoriasis, what should they do?
Okay. So psoriasis, for the benefits of our other listeners, is an autoimmune condition, tends to have a genetic tendency. The way it looks like, it's a red inflamed skin, which with some scaling or very thick scabs on the surface. And that tends to affect our elbows, knees, scalp, okay, And the less thought of organs, like the joints, the nails, okay? And also, in the last 10 years, a lot of evidence has shown that metabolic syndrome, i.e. high cholesterol, diabetes, hypertension, all the risk factors for succumbing to a stroke and a heart attack, is all tied in with having chronic or long-term psoriasis. Okay, so looking at that big picture in mind, what can we do? Now, as dermatologists, we, of course, we'll treat the skin externally, all right, with topical products, which will help to reduce the inflammation, to reduce the scaliness. Second line would be things like phototherapy, mainly UVB phototherapy, to try and reduce the inflammation likewise. Then thirdly, immunosuppressants, and fourthly, biologic agents. Now, the immunosuppressive and biologic agents are immunomodulators. In other words, we are trying to, we can't do gene therapy yet by changing the genes, mm-hmm. but we can reduce the genes which upregulates or increases the inflammatory signals within the body that brings out psoriasis. So I think for patients with severe psoriasis, with joint pains, and the joint pains that I'm talking about are the ones that you wake up first thing in the morning with achiness, stiffness, rather than the ones that you get after a long day at work or a long day in the gym. Mm. Okay, so it's more of disused pain, meaning if you've rested for about 10, 15 minutes and it hurts more rather than having worked it all day, then that is a very clear sign that you have inflammatory arthritis. And psoriasis is linked with psoriatic arthropathy, which is an inflammatory form of arthritis. So if we don't get onto treating that early and regulating the immune system, that can lead to deformed joints. And so if you typed in psoriatic arthropathy into a search engine online, you will start to see that there's a lot of deformities that you see. People are unable to keep their fingers straight anymore. But I'm very happy to say that now with increasing awareness and early intervention, we're not having those patterns anymore.
All right. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. Associate Professor Dr. Adrian Yong, consultant dermatologist and dermatological surgeon. It's been our open clinic segment on skin health. You've been listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.